Welcome to this Walnut Wednesday edition of the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's Walnut Wednesday episode, Taylor Charlstrom will have a report on the latest on managing nitrogen with high input prices, and Kylie Harlan reports on leaf sampling protocols to keep in mind. I'll have national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture and the Monterey County Farm Bureau are joining together to announce a release of California Agricultural Neighbors, Neighbor to Neighbor Best Practices to help enhance localized food safety efforts. California Agricultural Neighbors was formed in January of 2021 to bring together members of the Salinas Valley agriculture community to review what could be done to help reduce outbreaks of E. coli associated with leafy greens. CAN provided a roundtable opportunity to foster collaboration and discuss enhanced food safety practices between neighboring farms when various agricultural operations are adjacent to one another, including leafy greens, cattle ranches, vineyards, and compost sites. CAN membership includes representatives from production agriculture, as well as various industry and consumer associations, academia, and government. Actions for enhanced food safety outlined in a report include fostering neighbor-to-neighbor interactions and conversations, building a research roadmap for the Salinas Valley, creating a quantitative microbial risk assessment framework, and building and maintaining capacity to transfer knowledge from research into applied practice. Even though supplies of iceberg lettuce out of California have tightened up, there's enough availability to meet demand. Some of the volume decreases that are being experienced is a normal planned reduction for this time of the year as more local and regional harvesting comes into play for the summertime months, according to Matt Collins of Salinas-based Marcon. He says, but the recent heat and increased disease pressure in the Salinas Valley growing region is also beginning to reduce yields and affect overall supply levels. The recent high temperatures in the region have sped up the growth of iceberg lettuce and forced growers to harvest fields earlier than was planned. This is causing lighter weights and lowering overall yields because the plants have not had the normal amount of time to grow. They mature quickly so that the heads are not as dense, according to Collins. The problem is twofold. First, some heads won't meet Marcon's weight specifications, decreasing commodity availability. Second, it takes more heads to equal the same weight for processors. If this trend continues, it could cause a slight production gap in the coming weeks. Despite the heat wave and low weights across the industry, Marcon's grower partners have excellent quality, heavy weights, and high-yielding MFC iceberg as of right now. The Salinas Valley is a primary growing region for iceberg lettuce until early fall. Then iceberg production moves to Huron and Oxnard, California in October, and to Yuma, Arizona from November to April. At the same time, more local deals can be found for iceberg lettuce now, including from Colorado, Washington, and Santa Maria, as well as Canada and Mexico. Demand is strong, even more so with food service demand picking up. As long as folks continue dining out, keeping food service demand up, they expect it to remain strong, according to Collins. If consumers begin cutting back and eating more meals at home, they suspect iceberg demand will decrease. As for pricing, the market has been relatively stable at low levels for the past several weeks, but are beginning to firm up. These increases are not anything too out of the ordinary, according to Collins. Marcon expects the market to keep firming up into the high teens and possibly low $20 average. The Mexican grape season is wrapping up as the California season plans to start this week. In a crop update posted recently by Marcon Cooperative, the group says they will start shipping California-grown grapes when its Mexican supplies come to an end on July 10th. California-grown green seedless supplies are expected to begin shipping on July 12th, and red seedless stocks will start shipping this week. Expect higher prices to start the season, but markets will ease once California volume ramps up mid-July. According to Marcon, good quality is anticipated at the start of the season. IFG started a cherry breeding program 21 years ago. With California being their home base, the company is focused on breeding cherries that are suitable for Southern California's climate. This means they need to flourish despite lower winter chill hours, and they need to do well with a higher amount of summer heat. Through good and bad fortune these past 21 years, they've learned that global warming is a thing, according to Alwyn Van Jarsveld, IFG's International Commercial Cherry Manager. The California climate has become warmer and drier drier, but they're on the right track of bringing new varieties to market that are adaptable. In addition to breeding for low chill and hot weather, IFG also looks to bring novelties to the cherry category when it comes to color, size, shape, and marketing windows. This season, California saw some late spring rain events closer to the start of harvest. These rains had a negative impact on the quality as water stays on the fruit and causes the cherries to crack and split. They were breeding for varieties with a different shape that prevents water drops from hanging on the stem end. Time of maturity is another key trait in the new variety. In an ideal situation, a transition from one growing region to the next is smooth, so consumers can enjoy cherries uninterrupted and are not forced to switch over to other fruits. This year, the timing of California's cherry harvest was where it should be, but sugar levels in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia climbed very slowly due to cold weather. This has created a gap in supply, which has a huge impact, according to Van Jarsveld. Cherries are a cyclical product for retailers. It takes about 6 weeks to build up to full sales. If there's an interruption in supplies during those 6 weeks, a shipper falls back to week zero and has to build up sales from there again. Breeding a new variety takes time, and it takes even longer to see the results from commercial production. IFG produces about 6,000 seedlings per year, but so far only 10 varieties have been released commercially. They are very particular about what they like, according to Van Jarsveld. IFG Cheriton is a new sweet cherry variety and one of Van Jarsveld's favorites. It's a red, heart-shaped cherry with an early harvest window. In addition, its vigorous variety is adaptable to various weather conditions and survives rain. Production results have been very consistent. Another new cherry variety that is being tested and commercially grown in California and the Pacific Northwest is Cherry Glow. It is a yellow variety with a red cheek like Rainer. However, it precedes Rainer by about 7 to 14 days. It is great to have an early variety that is followed by a slightly later one to extend the length of season. Cherry Glow was planted commercially about 1 to 2 years ago. Given that cherry trees take about 4 years to bear fruit commercially, it will take a few more years before it is available on store shelves. Although Cherry Glow is not commercially available yet, it is good to have discussions with retailers about what's coming their way in a few years. It takes a long time to breed a suitable variety, and it's important to market it right away. If not marketed correctly, it could take another 5 to 6 years to get a second chance, if you're lucky, according to Van Jarsveld. The United States is a perfect petri dish of breeding cherries and fruit in general, according to Van Jarsveld. He referred to California's climate, but also to the opportunities there are to market the fruit. An affluent population that is hungry for novelty, and consumers that are used to having marketing in their face. However, outside of North America, IFG is taking cherries to new places where they haven't grown yet. These regions include Northern Victoria in Australia, but also China, South Africa, and north of Chile's fourth region. This northern growing region in Chile has an earlier window of production due to closer proximity to the equator. With 95% of Chile's cherries being exported to China, it is favorable to grow, pick, and ship cherries early for the Chinese New Year. IFG is looking forward to continuing to bring cherries with a wow factor to market. They are breeding for excitement and adaptability because what is the point of breeding more of the same, according to Van Jarsveld.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Taylor Charlstrom is in with this week's Walnut Wednesday report. He talks about the latest on managing nitrogen with high input prices.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture allows walnut growers in the state to apply up to 40 pounds of nitrogen per ton of in-shell walnuts in their orchards. However, UCCE research has found in recent years that only 29 pounds per ton in-shell are actually needed during the season. With fertilizer prices still way up, shrinking that number to the minimum is more important than ever for walnut growers, especially with current nut prices as well. UCCE Orchard Systems Advisor Kat Jarvis-Sheen recommends dividing that nitrogen evenly over the growing season, and this falls back to providing the right amount at the right time, in the right place, and in the right form.
We're trying to find that nitrogen sweet spot between applying not enough to grow a healthy crop and applying so much that a lot of it is going out of the root zone into a place where we can't use it and it might be detrimental to our neighbors. So to do that, it helps to know the right amount that the tree needs, when it needs it, and how the tree goes about getting it. To do that, it helps to understand how nitrogen acts in the soil and how it gets taken up by the tree. So let's go over some of those basics. So we have our soil here and the different forms of nitrogen that can be in it. We have soil organic matter, ammonium, and nitrate. So those are the three primary types of nitrogen, forms of nitrogen you'll find in the soil. You might also apply urea. That quickly turns into ammonium, so we'll just sort of treat urea like ammonium for the purpose of discussion. So soil organic matter is I think of it as sort of a nutrient vault, or you could say a nutrient savings account that you get a little bit of a dividend off of on a regular basis, but it's not a big dump of nitrogen into that's available to your plants. It's mostly tied up in big molecules. Whereas ammonium is one of the forms that roots can take up, and ammonium being positively charged, that's the chemical makeup of it underneath there in parentheses, and you see that plus, that indicates it's positively charged, it can stick in the soil fairly easily. Which means it's not leachable. Nitrate, on the other hand, it's another form that the plant can easily take up, but being negatively charged, it doesn't stick in the soil as well because the soil is also has a negative charge to it, especially the clay particles in the soil. So it can easily be leached through the root zone with water.
One important aspect of nitrogen uptake in plants that should be considered is that it's regulated because it uses energy. Ultimately, the tree will limit nitrogen uptake when beyond its needs, as to not waste energy.
The plant's not going to take up just all the nitrogen that you apply if it doesn't need it, right? Also, it goes through transporters in the roots. So putting on more nitrogen doesn't necessarily mean you can shove it all up into the tree, okay? There's bottlenecks that happen at these transporters if you apply too much nitrogen at once. So if we kind of imagine, you know, one big root, which is not the case, but we can think of, so ammonium is actually toxic in that form if it lives in tissue. So that has to be turned into amino acids in the root, and that takes energy. Nitrate has to be actively taken up by the roots, so that takes energy too. So again, both of these processes take energy. The tree's not going to waste energy just because, right? It's only going to take it up if it needs the nitrogen. So that comes back to this right rate idea, right? Of so only putting on as much as the tree tells you it needs based on the crop that it's trying to set.
In a year like this year with high prices, Jarvis Sheen recommends implementing nitrogen leaf samples into your decision-making process.
When we have these leaf samples, right, so we take our leaves in mid-July, anytime in July, we send them to a lab, they send us back the percent nitrogen in those leaves. What we want to target is that sweet spot in the green in the middle of we have enough nitrogen that we're getting good yields, we're getting good tree health. We're not over that amount, so putting on more nitrogen than the tree is able to use. And we're not under that amount, you know, causing nitrogen deficiency problems with the yield or the health of the tree. That sweet spot will be between 2.3 and 2.7 in your report. So that's where you want to be targeting in your report. And, you know, you could send in one leaf and the lab will send you a number. But you want to make sure that the number that you're getting back actually reflects what's happening in your orchard. To do that, you do need to put in a little work or ask your PCA to put in a little work. Trees, you want to be sampling 30 yards apart, so that ends up being about 4 trees apart in most orchard spacings. Otherwise, if you sample trees that are closer than that, you might as well just sample one instead of 2 of them. They're basically duplicates. And you want to sample at least 29 trees in every block, evenly distributed around the block, to get a solid confidence that the number that comes back from the lab is representative of what's actually happening in your orchard. That will land you in a plus or minus 0.1%, 95% of the time. So if in your orchard it is 2.5, sampling 29 leaves will get you in a 2.4 to 2.6, 95% of the time.
Once again, main nutrient takeaways for walnut nitrogen use is a minimum of 29 pounds of nitrogen per ton in shell. Divide that nitrogen evenly over the growing season between May and August. Keep the nitrogen in the roots in the top 2 to 3 feet along with irrigation water. And remember that all nitrogen can turn to nitrate and leach. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Charlstrom.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, working together to advance the industry. Together, we can do more.
In national agriculture news here today, the National Milk Producers Federation led 11 national agriculture, anti-hunger, nutrition, and medical groups in a virtual listening session with the White House on food access. The White House is holding its conference on hunger, nutrition, and health in September, and the groups want officials to place a high priority on accessing affordable, diverse, and nutritious foods. National Milk organized the session to offer the White House expertise and real-world experience from a wide range of organizations on how important increased access to food and a diverse range of food choices are to fight nutrition insecurity and improve nutrition-related health. The event is part of the broader effort to provide input to the White House as officials put together a new strategy to end hunger and increase healthy eating and physical activity among Americans by the year 2030. Officials say the White House plans to release its new strategy during the September conference. And speaking of dairy, for many producers, the most profitable cows in a milking herd are often the ones that go unnoticed. They're the invisible cows that go about their work of producing large volumes of milk and delivering healthy calves. In this report from Holstein Association USA, learn how genomic testing aids in identifying those quiet contributors to a dairy operation's bottom line. Ag News reporter Mile Ramsey has the story.
Ask David Earth, and he'll tell you, the journey to a more profitable cow herd begins with information. As a dairy technical services geneticist for Zoetis, he helps producers unlock their herd's genetic potential.
Information is very valuable. It gives us a more accurate picture of what those animals can be in their lives. The perfect world, we test calves shortly after they're born and make the decision, are they ones I want to invest in and keep?
IRF compares genomic testing to the draft in sports. Dairymen get their pick of the best animals that are suited to their operations.
It's a big thing on the sire side, and the traits that Zoetis has developed are really catching on in the industry. We're getting more and more people interested in trying to find those trouble-free cows, and part of getting those trouble-free cows is picking sires.
Now in its 12th year, genomic testing has grown and evolved in many ways. From initial traits for milk production and reproduction, the clarified suite of DNA tests includes powerful wellness traits to predict which animals are less likely to experience health events. And the results are impressive.
The mindset there was developing genomic traits that would help producers with their everyday problems. And the part that really impressed me was the willingness to go out and make sure these traits were working effectively in the field, basically validating them. And it's been really impressive seeing that data come in and seeing how effective these traits are in real world conditions.
By listening and responding to the needs of registered Holstein breeders, new traits are developed and released within the clarified test.
Traveling around the country and talking to producers from coast to coast, there's no producers that like cows that have twins or lose a calf after they become pregnant. Those are part of those everyday problems that we try to come up with some solutions for.
Zoetis partners with Holstein Association USA to provide the latest in genomic offerings to registered Holstein breeders.
The combination of the two organizations gives a lot of information and a lot of power with that information, and it helps the producers do better, because if we work together to develop things like our online data management system, Enlight, it gives the producers easier access to manage their information.
Information. It's the key to breeding a more profitable and healthy dairy herd. For Holstein Association USA, I'm Miles Ramsey.
Learn more by visiting HolsteinUSA.com. New York Representative Elise Stefanik and other House Republicans have introduced legislation that would prevent adversarial countries from acquiring American companies amid global food shortages. Stefanik says food security is a national security, and she's proud to stand against foreign adversaries as they attempt to exploit potential vulnerabilities and assert control over America's agricultural industry. The bill would specifically prevent countries like China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea from being allowed to buy American agricultural companies, citing them as prohibited. It also lists biotechnology and agriculture as critical infrastructure. Adversarial nations like China continue to threaten the homeland using tactics like buying American agriculture companies and stealing agricultural research to undermine the economy. That according to Stefanik. Fox News says the food security issue is a global problem because of the war in Ukraine, which has led to global food shortages. Republicans say Russia is using food manipulation as a weapon in its invasion of Ukraine. USDA has just announced some new crop insurance rules that may help lift one burden that many specialty crop producers have had to deal with. USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford.
Life may have just become a little easier for most growers of specialty crops who have crop insurance thanks to a new rule just out from the Agriculture Department.
The new rules will ease the burden of reporting considerably.
Marcia Bunger runs the USDA's Risk Management Agency. She says up to now, a specialty crop producer who has crop insurance would have to get a third-party adjuster or vendor to come in, verify production and marketing information for every crop that the farmer produces. That can be dozens of crops. Could be a time-consuming process, which producers of row crops like corn and soybeans don't have to do. They self-certify. And now with this new rule, so can most specialty crop producers.
They will be providing their own production information. It won't be necessary then to have a third-party verification. So they'll be able to use their own production records, which I think will be a huge benefit to direct marketers and vertically integrated producers.
But there will be random spot checks of farmers to make sure that production information is accurate. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And now Kylie Harlan has a report on leaf sampling protocols.
Analysis of tissue samples from your crop or orchard can determine if your plants are nutrient deficient or have toxicities that need to be addressed. Precision AgriLab, located in Madera, California, specializes in tissue analysis. Jenna Overmeyer, Market Development Specialist for the lab, tells us more about the business and what they do.
So Precision AgriLab, we are a lab located in Madera. We get samples all over. Specifically, we have a team that goes out up and down the valley, and we sample tissue samples, soil samples, water samples. We also do disease testing. So we have a team that actually goes out and pulls all those. And then we also have people who send in all their samples. So we sample tree nuts and orchards. Like we sample pistachios, almonds, citrus. We have grapes, but we also do a lot of row crops. We have garlic, onions, tomatoes, cotton. So there's a really good variety. The crops that we focus on are typically what we see around here. So the samples that we're getting is mainly what's grown throughout the valley. So specifically, it lets them know whether or not they're lacking in a specific nutrient and where to focus their fertility needs. A tissue analysis is important because it allows the grower to focus their investment better on what is actually needed.
Proper sampling times vary from crop to crop, and when the tissue is collected may also affect what crop it is used for. Jenna gives us more details on sampling timelines.
So early in the season, you're going to use those tissue samples for this year's crop. Later on, samples later on in the season is used for next year. Here in the valley, we sample almonds in April, May, June, and July for tissue samples. And pistachios, we start in May and we tissue sample through August.
Following sampling guidelines is important to ensuring accurate results. An accurate analysis may be difficult to obtain if correct, consistent parts of the plant are not selected. A common issue with leaf sampling is that those doing the sampling have not received proper training. To help combat this, Precision AgriLab has training videos available for pulling leaf samples.
It's important because the guidelines we use for our reports are based on years of experience from the universities. So if you sample incorrect parts, you can get untrue results. So for example, in almonds, we sample the most recent mature leaf from a non-expanding, non-fruiting spur. So if you were to sample immature growth, you may get results that show you are deficient. It's important to follow the sampling guidelines in order to execute sampling properly. For the specific crop that you're sampling, there's guidelines that you need to go by. And really just being consistent in your sampling process. You want to sample from the same areas. You want to be sampling frequently so you can monitor the changes throughout the season. You also want to make sure that you're sampling trees that represent the entire block. So you want to avoid replants, and you want to sample trees that represent the majority of what the trees look like in that field. For example, if you have problem areas, it's probably best to do a separate sample, or you can even do a good, healthy sample and a bad, weak sample. That's a great option to compare the two.
If you have any questions regarding sampling, Jenna says to give the lab a call or visit their website, www.precisionagrilab.com, for more information. This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.